Here we are, Always Record, episode 27. Today, launching SyncBook Volume 2. You can find that at thesyncbook.com. That's the, S-Y-N-C, thesyncbook.com. SyncBook Volume 2. That's pretty damn awesome.
Good morning, sir.
Hola, ¿cómo estás ustedes?
Muy bien. ¿Y tú?
Had a really slow response.
Hey, man, it's
how
been
are
a
you this
year.
Morning?
I don't get as much Spanish practice as I used to.
It's so horrible, dude. I took like 4 years of Spanish, and the only thing that I really remember how to say is "el pollo muerto está caliente," which means the dead,
dead chicken is very hot. Yeah.
What are you doing? Are you getting ready for an Always Record this morning?
I still got it, man. I know how to say chicken. that's the plan. I just got a message from that he's not going to be able to make it today, so I'm just setting up to record on my end.
Who are you going to have then?
I have no idea.
I have to go.
Yeah, are you? That's what I was figuring.
I wish it would be fantastic if I could just sit. I love even the new, like every single. There's not a single Always Record that I have a problem with. They're all just so good and so easy to listen to. It's
weird. That's great to hear. Thank you. I figured you might be on your way out, but I thought I'd reach out to you just in case. Are you leaving now?
Yeah, I mean, real soon. I just happened to be like working on Green Room Edit when you called. And I was on Skype because Doug had sent me a music track that he wanted on the new Green Room, and I had left it open. So it's just serendipitous that you caught me.
All right. So the book's out on Amazon, by the way. I don't know if you saw on Facebook.
Yeah, I know. I saw that. That's amazing. How are you feeling? You feeling like a little bit of weight's been lifted now? You have a lot to worry about, don't you? Are you getting inundated with requests from the authors on getting copies and stuff like that?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, there's like so much administrative stuff to do. But I mean, basically, I'm just kind of getting back to my life very shortly. I have a lot of things I need to do that I've put off, basically anything that's even remotely important for personal reasons, like, you know, paying for rent and things. So, a lot of shit that I gotta get back to. But today, you know, not today. Today we're gonna, you know, see who we could talk to, have some fun, make a little bit of a happy day out of it, and then I can get back to other things tomorrow.
Awesome.
So I hope you will have a great day.
Yeah. In fact, I wanted to tell you, man, that I know how many interviews that you've done, and I haven't really ever listened to any of them unless they were like directly sent to me or whatever, just because I'm lazy like that. But I've been going back lately and listening to quite a few of yours, and I love you, bro. You're just a good guy. I mean, I listen to the different situations. I think, is that Kevin Halcott's online?
Yeah, he said he was going to call me today.
Awesome. Yeah, I just saw him pop up. Yeah, but, you know, I heard you mentioning me in one of the podcasts and everything, and just the dream. Like, I had forgot about the peacock dream. So I listened to you talk to that about that. And it's just, I think that you've handled yourself really well, man. You've always, I think that you're getting better at it, at least.
I feel like in the last year it's a lot easier. Like, there's still a few, like, for the most part, you know, like you said, the situations sometimes change where sometimes I feel like if someone's really coming at it from, like, a hardcore conspiracy place, it's a little hard for me to, you know, then you have to kind of, like, try and explain why I'm not taking that position or, you know, whatever it is.
But yeah, I do chip away at that, yeah.
But I definitely feel, like, so much more comfortable than I did a year ago. So
it's just you're just really personable. I mean, whoever you're talking to, you're kind of always laughing and joking around with them, and it's not, you don't come off as like some salesman. You're just like coming off as like, you know, yeah, there's a shitload to this, people. Like there's a lot to Sync. It's just I think that you've done the whole genre a lot of justice, man. And especially this new book, man. Something about this thing coming out just seems like it completes the first one. Do you know what I mean? Like it just, it's like a sequel in a franchise, not just the part two, but like part three or four that makes all the rest of them better. Sort of like not Attack of the Clones, but Revenge of the Sith, where it's like, okay, I hated the first two movies, but I see now why the whole thing is important. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. It's just, the completion of the two books together already just makes it seem like more of a package, like less fringe.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm trying my best here. And then there's, sorry, you said you did see Kevin Halcott come online?
Well, this is Kevin. Maybe this is my brother.
Oh, yeah, because
Kevin, the United States.
For some reason, Halcott's not even showing up. I'm like, oh, there he is. No, I don't have him online yet. The way I feel about this book, so it's not like the first book was shit and this one completes it, and it's not like this book shit. The thing is that I feel like it's more balanced this way. Like the first one, we had like a lot of people from the Kotzian point of view. Not that I'm like opposed to that. You know, I really feel like that's an important thing to say. I'm not trying to like attack Kotze at all. I just feel like it wasn't balanced. You know, it's like there's a lot of like one view on it. And then even the guys, you know, there's so many guys who have other perspectives on it. And even like some of the like the conspiracy viewpoints or contrarian viewpoints, I feel like we needed to pay some like attention to those to make it feel more rounded out. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it feels like important in that respect. It feels like a more like honest approach to like researching it and sort of hashing this stuff out than I don't know. So it's just I like the idea of just being getting a wider perspective.
There's just so much activity going on right now, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
With Joe Alexander and everything like that. Like, we got Mark LeClaire. You probably already know, but Mark LeClaire is coming on to next week.
Yeah, I did see that. What's with Joe Alexander? You said a lot of activity with Joe Alexander. What happened? He put out a new video?
Well, he put out the auto-tune video. Have you seen the auto-tune video?
Yes, I did see that. That was good.
Yeah, and it just all of a sudden, like, you had told me once before that it was more Jake than Jake.
Yeah, totally.
And all of a sudden, when he put out the auto-tune video, it's like Jake and Jim and, like, people like Jennifer Palmer all of a sudden turned around and go, oh, look at this great new synchro mystic, Joe Alexander. Like, it was funny because it just grabbed some people's attention. All of a sudden, people know who Joe Alexander is.
Yeah. I actually saw the other day, I saw that you and Jake were having a conversation on Twitter about the 42 minutes, and where he was like, oh, it's a really good 42 minutes. And I was like, I thought that was interesting that he was going back and listening to the older Joe Alexander ones. And but it's great. I'm happy that Joe's getting some attention because he deserves it. He's so good. His videos are so solid.
Okay, so I do have Kevin Halcott on the line, or he's blowing me up on Skype, so I'm going to add him to this call, okay?
Yeah.
He popped up, and it said Kevin, and then he says, hey, bro, you doing a sync call? And I was like, is this Kevin Morgan, meaning my brother? And he goes, Halcott. But he knows that because he and I have talked before how he is like a sync brother to me, like somehow. Mr. Halcott.
Hello.
What's up, man? How are you?
Hey, how's it going? I'm good. How you doing?
Not too bad. It's only just by coincidence that I happen to be on here, so I'm going to be stepping off here soon, but Alan is looking for you. So
cool.
Hey. Kevin, good to hear you, man.
Hey, how's it going, Alan?
It's a good day. It's a good day. Things are going all right.
Good, good.
What did you do for the full moon, lunar eclipse?
Really just kicked it. I spent some time outside just kind of hanging, absorbing some lunar beauty, you know, and I think kind of just smoked some pot, took it easy, you know.
That's the way to do it. Nothing more than that is necessary, I don't think. It's the simple sort of appreciation.
Yeah, it's funny, I like spent the week, I had some time to do some blogging and stuff, and was just hanging with my brother, and he was getting into this like Sam Rockwell moon connection, and so I was like really in training with the moon all week, like not even realizing that the full moon was really so near, and so I was definitely feeling it without really knowing it.
we've been talking about this book, the Sync Book 2, is like really has this lunar theme. Like a few of the chapters deal with the moon. The cover has like all these lunar elements on it, like all these moon aspects that they're designed into it. And then it ends up coming out on the day of a full moon lunar. Like we actually didn't plan that. We just months ago we were just like, hey, what day? Well, we couldn't get it done before Thanksgiving. All right, let's try for the week after Thanksgiving. That was it. That was all the planning. You know, it's like. And then suddenly it ends up coming out with a full moon eclipse. I'm like, all right, there's the timing's perfect. It's just there.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm really pumped about it. It looks great. You know, the cover design and everything looks really attractive. I'm psyched for it.
Justin's good, man. Justin is good.
Mm-hmm.
David, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Is one of you guys talking on the road? Is someone driving and doing a Skype call?
Oh, you know, I'm actually outside my house. Is that coming through heavily?
Yeah. we try and do this with headphones if possible, though that wouldn't really make much of a difference with that. That's for other reasons. But I don't know.
I'll move indoors right now. That's cool. I was just having a smoke, so I'll move indoors.
Don't worry. You know, what I would just say is a good thing for everyone is just to say when you're not talking, mute your mic. This way that stuff's not coming through. But enjoy your smoke. Don't worry. We're not.
Yeah. This is a pretty casual show we got here, so don't worry about it.
Okay. Cool. Well, Dave, nice to meet you. Or, hi. You know, virtually meet you.
This is... Kevin,
The Logosphere.
Oh, okay. Okay. Cool. Totally. Yeah. Awesome.
Do you have a blog, Dave?
New Creatures Magical Mystery Tour.
Oh, so cool. I've checked that out right on.
Yeah. I've read your blog a whole hell of a lot. I really like it a lot. It's great.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Nice to have you on the show.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
So, Bill couldn't make it today.
Yeah, I just got the message, so...
He said he lost his mind last night or something.
Yeah, I wasn't going to throw that out until the recording, but yeah.
did you see what I wrote back to him?
No, what did you say?
I thought that happened years ago, Humpty, and I said, I'll call all the king's horses and men to help you out or something.
I think he should have brought whatever... crazy epiphany he had, he should have brought it on.
Yeah. sometimes you need a moment to integrate before.
Oh, I know. I'm kidding.
Your thoughts. Yeah, it's like, you know, yeah. But no, I
All right. So I'll share my ridiculously stupid epiphany. Last night in my sleep, this was like some dream epiphany, but it's not, you know, no major revelation here. But so Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, right? They eat pizza, and they always want pizza with mushrooms on it. Now, what do mushrooms grow in? Particularly, you know, magic mushrooms.
cow pies, right?
Yeah. What do they always say? What do the Ninja Turtles always say?
Cowabunga.
or cowadunga.
Yeah. Or cowafunga. Cowafungus.
So I woke up this morning and I'm like, oh. And my wife's like, is that your big epiphany for? She's like, is that your message from the gods that you're going to share with everyone today? I'm like, you know, if that's all it is.
I had this whole thing with the Ninja Turtles where I was arranging the different characters on the Tree of Life and looking at the four Ninja Turtles as like, you know, in the lower Sphero, you have that each one has their rainbow color, you know, and so you could kind of look at them as this rainbow connection. But then I was considering like, well, who's Malkuth then? And I'm like, Malkuth in the European schools is taken as the feet. And so I'm like, obviously, like the Foot Clan, like the whole Foot Clan is Malkuth. And then I was like looking at Splinter and Shredder and considering that Bina and Chokmah were taken to be wood and metal in different schools of like applying the tree with alchemy. And so I'm like, wood and metal, Splinter, like you get a splinter from wood, and obviously Shredder is metal, so you have wood and metal there, which is perfect because then you have wisdom and understanding. Like Splinter then would be understanding, whereas Shredder would be wisdom, which is sharp and just cuts through. And so then I was like going through this whole thing and I'm like, okay, April O'Neil, I was equating her with Mercury, and so I guess I placed her with Netzach. But anyways, and then Casey Jones I had as Hode, so they're opposites, you know, and he's Jason. So you have like Jason and the Argonauts, and then you have April O'Neil. April means Aphrodite. Aphrodite is the one who kills Jason, technically, in the story, which was interesting. But then I was like, what's Tiferet? And I was taking Tiferet as pizza because everything's taking from Tiferet and she's, you know, the source material. So it's like, it's this idea that everything's feeding off of that. So I'm like, totally, the pizza's in the center. And then it's like the idea that, you know, however you slice the pizza, it's still pizza. It's kind of, you could apply that philosophically.
Sure. Would you put Krang as Dot?
Is Krang the brain?
Yeah, the brain.
Yeah, totally. Or right. Cat.
Because look, he's this brain, but like his brain has been lowered down. His brain is like in his stomach, right?
Yeah. No, that's perfect. Totally. Yeah.
He's like the lowered crown.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then also the turtle in the first place, like when you look at a turtle shell, you can see it has like the shining floor pattern before room 237, like the hexagonal shapes. It's all arranged in hexagons. So that's also like, you know, you could take that as symbolic of the tree. The tree is hexagons, two hexagons.
You know, for Sync Book 2, Ezra Sansarbel, he did his piece is about music and alchemy, but also how it connects to the I Ching, which is based off of turtle shells.
Wow.
Right, so like you have this turtle shell connection to the I Ching, and then, of course, they're, you know, the sort of heroes in a half shell, which I guess is Venus, right? It's Venus on the half shell. But,
Wow. Yeah, no, I'm processing that. That's really interesting. Okay.
Okay, so my wife, for no reason whatsoever, started calling me Splinter the other day.
Are you serious? Because
she said that I make giant nest like a rat.
Huh.
So she's like, Splinter! Splinter, get in here! She's just giving me a hard time, right? But then I was watching the Comic Book Men with Kevin Smith. I have a DVR now, and I don't watch very many TV shows, but I started watching these comic books about his secret stash, you know, Jay and Silent Bob comic book shop, and it basically is just like a pawn star where people come in and sell comics to him and shit like that, and it just shows you, and it's just like, you know, Geek Boy Central, but they had this original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles that they came in and were trying to sell for like $20,000 or something the other day. Like original pencils. And for some reason I was just thinking about turtles and, you know, look at the turtle of enormous girth on his shell. He holds the earth and you guys talking about turtles just blows my fucking mind. Like I didn't say anything. But for some reason, it coming up over and over again. But what were you saying about Jason? Because I did this whole thing where Jason was the moon to me. You know, you have Casey Jones and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but
sure,
like the hockey mask represented the reflective face of the moon with the craters.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah, no, okay, so I'm looking right now for a piece of artwork that I did where I communicate my idea around, like, April being Aphrodite, and I think Alan might remember it because it's Jason Takes Manhattan, so it's, like, got the New York theme going on, but you're taking a second, but yeah, no, it's I don't remember the story that well, but I can remember that Aphrodite, who is Venus, right, by extension,
it's Venus.
She was the cause of Jason's death in the story, technically speaking. Like, she didn't directly kill him in a violent way, but she was the one who was ultimately responsible, which is interesting.
Can I just add, I think it's interesting, last night my wife was out with a friend of hers, and she went to a place called Argo Tea, and I was like, Argo Tea? And I'm thinking, like, why would you go to, like, so, like, I'm thinking, okay, Jason and the Argonauts. And I didn't think, it was just like this thought of, like, I wonder what that means. And now we're talking about Jason and the Argonauts. It's pretty funny.
So there was a film that just came out called Argo, right? Who was in
Of Kevin Smith, isn't Argo made by the guy, what's his face, Pretty Boy, who got his break from Kevin Smith?
Yeah, Ben Affleck.
Ben Affleck didn't. His first movie was like Mallrats, right?
Right. Totally. Yeah, and he was in Chasing Amy.
Maybe Chasing Amy.
Weird. Yeah, so this is the image. And so basically, I was looking at, you have Freya. So Freya is, by extension, you know, you have this, I don't know what you call it exactly, but you have the gods come one out of the other. And so this is one way of spelling Freya that I found. And so I was looking at Friday comes from Freya. So when we say Friday, that's what it means. And so when we say April, we're also saying Aphrodite. And so I thought it was interesting, like putting like Aphrodite as April O'Neil in the shot, but then putting the Jason mask on her in terms of like kind of like the king kill idea, where like you kill the king and then you take on the king's identity. It's like Aphrodite, who's a symbol of like peace and love, like basically becomes the very thing that she ends up destroying. So, and then I put like the Aztec calendar there at her crotch for, you know, I don't know. I was considering, I think that they had the whole like 13 moon thing too. So I was considering like 13, like Freya the 13th, just kind of playing around. But yeah, it was kind of fun.
Hey, can I throw something out here? You know, speaking of all this sort of the 13 and the King Kill, you know, we've gone back and forth on the 13 or the MM as being connected, like your Marilyn Manson and just on and on and on. Well, you know, we were playing around the last few days with these, like, you know, photoshopping the Sync Book 2 cover into different movie stills and things. So I did the shot from The Big Lebowski where, and I know a bunch of Sync heads have connected this to 9/11 and to the moon and to the Twin Towers. There's that shot where Saddam Hussein is handing Jeff Bridges the shoes. Mm-hmm. And then it looks up this whole tower of shoes at the moon, and then it comes back down. You guys know that shot.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
People have pointed out that, over his shoulder, the only shoes you can read, it says 11/11.
That's the ones that Hussein actually points to him. Saddam Hussein, like, directly points to 11/11.
But if you look in the shot, there actually is another pair of shoes that you can read the numbers. So there's also, on the bottom right-hand corner, there's a 13/13.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yeah.
There you go.
Those are some big shoes to feel. This whole Big Feet thing comes up a lot, too. Like Bigfoot.
Oh, Bigfoot. Yeah.
Yeah, Harry and the Hendersons, I loved in the Moon Key video, the way that that ties in so nicely, where you have what's the name of that character from Third Rock from the Sun who plays the alien on that show?
John Lithgow.
Yeah, so John Lithgow was in the ape movie, the new Planet of the Apes, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and then you have him hanging out with Harry and Harry and the Hendersons.
Yeah.
Pretty perfect.
And 2010.
Well, see, I was thinking that, too, because the monkey or the moon thing is this has to do with the Golden Gate. It blew my mind when I watched Joe Alexander's new movie, and he talks about the Silver Gate and the Golden Gate. Kevin, did you know about that as far as, like, the where Galactic Center is? But I realized that Ophiuchus and his big foot is on the Golden Gate. Do you see that?
What do you mean? I don't understand.
Okay, the Bigfoot, because I think Harry and the Henderson takes place in the same area as because it had they take him to the Redwoods and stuff.
Yeah.
And they drop him off in the woods. So it's basically the same movie, Harry and the Henderson and Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, totally.
And there's that scene where Harry's watching the apes too. So the Golden Gate is one of the biggest landmark in Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Like, they cross the Golden Gate Bridge. There's all these monkeys going across this Golden Gate Bridge so they can get to the axes, the tree, the garden.
Sure.
But it's Bigfoot. And it's Bigfoot on the Golden Gate Bridge. And the Golden Gate, it has to do with – that's why I was asking Kevin, because I'm not sure. And Joe Alexander only says it for – you know how they talk about the going across Galactic Center as crossing the road, and then – Joe Alexander in his movie mentioned something about the Golden Gate and the Silver Gate and how they're the lining up of the our procession through the Galactic Center or whatever. But it's the Golden Gate. He specifically says, like, that us becoming in alignment with Galactic Center has something to do with the Golden Gate. And Ophiuchus is on the Golden Gate. And the Bigfoot is Ophiuchus's big foot, his boot, that's stepping on the snake that's right where the Galactic Center is.
Right. Well, he's stepping on the tail of Scorpio, I believe. Ophiuchus, his foot steps on the stinger of Scorpio, if I'm not mistaken.
Which also points, like, to Galactic Center. I mean, it's all like...
Sure, it's all right there, yeah. Galactic Center is right in between the two.
So I see Rise of the Planet of the Apes as this crossing the center, crossing the axis. He's walking... It's Ophiuchus, like, treading on the Golden Gate, or treading on...
Totally. Yeah, that's really interesting.
And Wally, too, because I remember, and it all has to do with that plant. It's just all this return to the tree, return to the garden that was in Wally as well, because Wally has the plant in the boot. He has.
Right. Which is perfect, because then you have Eva is obviously Eve, and then you have, like, Eve in the garden. And so they're trying to get back to the garden. Got to find our way back to the garden.
Right. And the only way to do that is to cross the Golden Gate.
Right. That's awesome.
Go ahead, Dave.
No, you go ahead. It's fine.
I was just going to say, I called Will, when I came onto Skype, I called Will first. He was the first one I saw on Skype, and we were just, like, chatting for a few minutes. And one of the first things he says to me is about a dead chicken. So I'm thinking, like, why did the chicken cross the road? Your whole time is, like, crossing the center, crossing the path, crossing through the gate. And I'm thinking, like, why
to
did
get
the...
to the other side.
Yeah, why did the dead chicken cross the road?
The whole point of 2012 is to get to the other side.
Right.
So last night I looked at the short introduction video to Secrets in Plain Sight from the contributor Scott Onstott.
Scott Onstott.
And he flashes the Golden Gate Bridge, and I had this moment while watching it where I was like, huh, I live really close to the Golden Gate Bridge, and so I was like, I don't know. I was like, huh. I mean, I've seen it my whole life, you know, and I know a little bit of its history, but the symbolism of the Golden Gate, I was just started thinking about. And then after watching that, I watched Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness with Melancholia, which are both most in all likelihood named after the same etching from, like, the 16th century of Saturn. And it's fucking incredible. Like, they're the same length of time. Like, the film and the album are the same length of time. And the album is divided into two parts, and the movie's divided into two parts. And it's just, like, the way the two meet each other is perfect. I need to do some experimenting to get, you know, to look at timing and to see if there's any timing that fits best, but holy fuck. And so, I don't know, I was thinking about, okay, so I'm watching this, and I remembered that when Kirsten Dunst rearranges the pictures, the paintings in this room, at one point when she's really upset and she turns everything around, one of the pictures is of, what is it, bring me the head of, I'm spacey right now, John the Baptist. So you have John the Baptist's head or whatever, and I noticed that. But I had never noticed that in the corner later on in the second half of the movie, if you look closely at one of the paintings that's there, it's a section from the Garden of Earthly Delights. And so in the corner where you have these birds, and so the birds in the Garden of Earthly Delights, which is the centerpiece of Bosch's painting, you know, is like right there in that room. And I was like, wow, like, okay, I've been seeing this parallel between that film and Antichrist, which they go to Eden, if you guys have ever seen. The same guy who did Melancholia did this film, Antichrist. And the woman who's in it, opposite Kirsten Dunst in Melancholia, she is basically plays the character of Eve. And you have a man and a woman and their dead child, but the man and the woman, they never say their names in the entire film, in Antichrist. But the woman who is supposed to be, by implication, the Antichrist, and they use the Venus symbol for the T of Antichrist, she is the woman who can't handle the end of the world in Melancholia. And so there's
the same actress, you mean? The same?
Yeah, the same actress. And
so it's the Kirsten Dunst's sister.
Yeah. And so I was tripping out on this whole thing in Melancholia when the horse won't cross the bridge. Like, there's this horse, and she beats
the horse.
Won't cross
the golden gate. Won't cross the golden
gate. Exactly. And that gate reappears in Antichrist, even though Antichrist came first. But it's that woman can't cross the bridge. She has this fear of crossing the bridge into Eden. She's trying to get into Eden, and she doesn't want to cross the bridge. And she ends up just running across it. And this is the funny... Okay.
The horse is also symbolic of like sexual energy or the beast as well, like in Seabiscuit.
Oh, totally. Yeah, it's vitality, right? And then the devil itself is vitality. I mean, that's how it's taken. And if you look at like the idea of like Orgon or your Kundalini energy is itself, you know, Luciferian in a sense. So that's right. Interesting. Listen,
because I got to go and I want to apologize because this is like gut wrenching. I would love just to sit back and talk with you guys all day. But,
oh, bummer. Okay.
But vaya con Dios.
Well, have a great day, my friend. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye, guys.
Oh, bye. I didn't realize he was just going to be on for a minute. I probably would.
Do you want to finish that thought out or?
Yeah, kind of. Who's the fucking guy on the cover of Platoon? I am slightly spacey with all the, even though I'm making these connections. The actor, shit, what's his name? What's the guy? Who's the guy who's The Last Temptation of Christ?
Willem Dafoe?
Yeah, so Willem Dafoe is the opposite the girl in Antichrist, and Willem Dafoe is Christ in The Last Temptation of Christ. And then you have this movie Antichrist, and then he's there in the role. And so there was this really interesting connection there. But I was just realizing, like with Melancholia, when the horse doesn't want to cross the bridge is actually into Aden. And then that's kind of like why you see like the Garden of Earthly Delights there, and that they're basically like they're in the garden. And so I was just going to say that when that came up, when I watched that last night with the bridge, I visualized the Golden Gate. And so it's interesting, like bringing up the Golden Gate in this respect to get to paradise. That was just literally on my mind just last night. So it's interesting.
So have you seen Joe Alexander's video, the auto-tune video?
No.
That he was talking about?
Future videos.
So I think he connects, it could be this video, I could be wrong, but isn't it like there's the Golden Gate, there's a one side of the Golden Gate that's like famous for suicides? Like people jump off, but like always on one side of the bridge, not the other. So it was sort of like, I think it was in that video, he's connecting it to like, this is the Golden Gate as like this passageway to the to the other side, like the other side, the you know, after death and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and that people can't make it, but in a sense they're actually making it by it's like the middle path or something. It's like you could go from one pole to the other, but really on both sides it's ultimately the same thing, or you can just jump off in the middle and transcend the whole deal. I don't know if paradise is really on the other side of that gate. I mean, I've driven over it many times and
yeah, I don't
it might not be the city, but
don't,
you know,
take it too literally. Oh man. Hey Kev. You still there? What's the studio that you guys were just recording at? That has an interesting name.
We were at a place called the Treehouse Studio in New Paltz.
Oh, Treehouse.
Yeah, and we were also recorded the first part of the record in this like a Mobile theater. I can't remember.
Oh, you're cutting out there. I can't hear anything. Hello?
Hey.
You can't hear me?
Oh, that sounded queer. Say something now.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Hello?
Hello.
Hey. Hello.
Kevin, hello. We can hear you. I hear you saying hello. You did cut out there for a minute, but I think you're better now.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so we recorded at a place called the Treehouse Studio, maybe. I don't know if that's what you're thinking about.
Well, we could dissect Treehouse, but there was something else, right? There was like a old church or something.
I played a show in Jersey recently where I found this really awesome old church, like stone church. And maybe that was it. I don't know. I mean, we did record the first half of the record in like an abandoned vaudeville theater. It was like
that's what it was. House. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was in the first capital of New York, Kingston. And it was cool. There was a place around the corner, like 42 Crown Street. It was like looked like an old tea house or something that had closed down. The Freemasons were just three doors down from us too. That was pretty funny.
What are you still? Are you? I know last time I spoke to you, I think you were getting involved with the OTO. Are you still involved with them?
The OTO, briefly was going down for some of their public stuff, but I can't afford to be really part of the community down there. But I am currently a member of the Astron Argon, or the AA, you know?
Uh-huh, sure, yeah. My initials.
So, actually, I'm sorry?
No, I just said those are my initials, yeah.
That's awesome. I actually just got accepted into the neophyte grade, so I'm like officially a member of the inner college and such now, so I'll be like instructing probationers and you know, as I move along the path and stuff. So it's it's been really cool, but AA is just all work from home, you know. It's like keep in touch with an instructor through the mail kind of thing, so it's very, very secret, you know.
A secret between you, the person on the other side, and your mailman.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, the mailman, man, he would probably have no idea what he's reading when he reads that stuff. But it's cool. My instructor up here is a really cool guy. He's got a really great website. It's astronargon.us, and he's done a lot of really great like scholar. Excuse me, I choked on my coffee. He's done a lot of really great, like, scholarly occult work that it really borders on synchromysticism, which I found really cool. Like, when I've gotten further into, like, occult studies, the way, you know, the tradition associates things by their nature and by association of, you know, sphere and planet and color, or, you know, all these kind of numerological things. Like, you know, it's amazing how close, you know, occult research and sync association are really the same, you know? So, yeah, I'd recommend anybody who's like into sync occultism to check out the Astron Argon website. There's some really great articles on there.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. Looks like this looks pretty cool. I'm going to look more at this.
Yeah, I mean, this lineage is a direct line right back to Crowley through the Marcello Motta traditions. So there's, you know, it's weird when you get deeper into it, there's all sorts of like people saying like, oh, this lineage isn't real. That lineage is, you know, doing the wrong thing, blah, blah, blah. And I could tell that the, you know, brother that I'm associated with is really, really hardworking and has like fought really hard to maintain a really clear tradition. He's been through the lawsuits with the OTO and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, yeah, this lineage is definitely really good and true to form. So that's a good site to learn about, you know, that kind of stuff on for sure.
Yeah, it's all sync. I mean, we just go right out and say it. Whereas, like, I mean, it's completely implied when we say sync. But when you look at what are the prime tools that are being used to extrapolate the information with these different systems, and the OTO is obviously one of them. But I mean, mysticism across the board plays with correspondences. So this corresponds to this. But then you're basically getting information because of how these two things connect, or
right,
three things or whatever. So you're like, how does this relate to this? And so there's information inherent in the relationship that you wouldn't get with the thing alone. It's like you watch the Wizard of Oz, and it's a really good movie with lots of symbolism, and then you put it on mute and you watch it with Dark Side of the Moon, and you get a whole other message. Whereas, like, if you listen to Dark Side of the Moon all by itself, it's a really great album all on its own with its own set of symbolism, but the two together produce something that you wouldn't have otherwise. And so, like, you know, 777... the book, Crowley's Book of Correspondences, I mean, all that is sync. Like, that whole book is sync. It's like a sync handbook, you know? So, and then that's foundational in terms of the work. So,
right,
you know, you want it to be instantaneous. That's the goal, right? So as soon as you say, you know, Gavora, you want to be able to visualize the corresponding color. You want to be visualizing, you know, boom, red, okay, and like, and then everything that comes
right,
with
it,
you're like
Gavora,
Mars, you know,
right.
You're like Mars, what does Mars mean? And you want to basically get as less, like, you don't want a conceptual understanding of Mars, you want an energetic understanding of Mars. Like, you want to be in touch with what we're talking about when we say Mars, like, beyond like any image of the planet, or what are we getting at here, what are we looking at. And so you're like, okay, Mars has to do with like tobacco or cocaine would be signifiers of Mars energy. And so you're like, okay, well, what do those things have in common, you know? It's like
right.
Yeah, severity, you know, but that's like just one example. And then how does this relate to this? Like, my favorite description of Crowley with the tarot, with working with the 78 cards of the tarot, he's like, imagine if you went to the same party every night and you had 78 people and you had groups of however many, you have 10 people of these 78 people and they get together, what is their dynamic going to be? You know, and every night you're dealing with a different combination and different people relating. So every time these people relate, you're going to have something coming different out of the different correspondences. Like, these people have what they're about, and then it's like, it's almost like these people have different jobs every night too. It's like, okay, they're the same people, but now they have different jobs. It's like,
right. Yeah, definitely. I feel like, you know, sync is really connected with the mystical kind of the mystical intent to kind of carry like up to date, you know, knowledge and wisdom, you know. And I feel like what sync does is really cool, is because it creates, I really feel like we've almost been creating like a new Kabbalah in a way where, you know, we're taking, seem to be like mashing up the world around us and associating the archetypes and almost like adjusting them to the way we actually see the world happening on another level, you know? So like, I feel like that's always been the work of, you know, mysticism, is to kind of interpret nature's, you know, path and then kind of reflect on that and like integrate and adjust, you know, our understanding to flow with that, you know? And so I feel like, yeah, there's definitely like a real, you know, strong connection, whether intentional or not, to kind of like keep an ongoing dialogue with nature.
Totally.
Hey, Freeman, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
I am doing well.
Now, we're just having a little conversation here about all things esoteric and mystical and launch of the Sync Book 2 and all that sort of stuff.
Nice.
You know, today's the day?
Today's the day.
Sync Book 2.
Well, I thought it was the 27th was the day.
Well, yeah, we kind of launched it a little early, but that was like today's the day observed, I guess.
All right. I can live with that.
Yeah, congrats, guys. I'm psyched on it.
I'm sitting here mindlessly working on my flash drive. I didn't think it was going to be such a task.
Mm-hmm. You're disassembling it?
Yeah, I wish. Well, in a way, yeah. Like, I realized that I had a lot of low-res, low-definition versions, and I had to go remake the high-def ones, remastering everything. And
oh, for sure. I've done a ton of that, particularly lately. What are you working on now? Are you doing the magazine or a new video?
Well, I'm working on the flash drive currently, and Jamie's working on the magazine. But as soon as I got this flash drive done, then I'm back on magazine duty.
Oh, so, the flash drive is the I understand. This is the old audio. This is the audio flash drive.
Yeah, the Best of Freeman flash drive. I'm trying to, you know, go through 7 years of content and pick out the best stuff, and then find the highest quality version of that, and put in all the description pictures and all that crap. You know.
Oh yeah, people. I don't think people realize how much labor goes into this sort of stuff.
Oh my God, it's been a week. It's just a week nonstop. It's ridiculous. Yeah. It's like, why am I doing this? But I think it's going to be awesome. I really do. But yeah, then, you know, digging deep into weird stuff for sure.
Congratulations, by the way. Both Freeman and Kevin, congratulations, both of you, for having successful Kickstarters. I know a lot of people try Kickstarter, but congratulations to both of you for being successful.
Yeah, it was amazing. You know, you can get blown away by what support you find. But then I also get baffled because I saw a deck of cards did 10 times as good as I did.
Really?
Dude, never, you know, if I had sold a deck of cards and made $150,000, I mean, the guy that made the deck of cards only asked for $5,000 or $6,000, I don't remember, but he ended up making $150,000.
What was his deck of cards? What was so special about it?
Nothing. Just a deck of cards. He just redesigned the artwork.
Oh, man.
Wow.
So it leads me to this question, this nagging question, why? Because it was same price, right? You could buy the deck of cards or you could buy weird stuff. It was same price. And I'm wondering why this guy got 3,000 people to pledge to his deck of cards. And especially, I mean, you know, going well over his you know, his goal. I mean, the goal being $6,000 and making $146,000. What was, you know, what's the secret there?
What was he doing? What did he?
I never could find out, honestly, how he managed. You know, for weird stuff, I was on the radio every day of the month, every single day, and I was broadcasting, I was publishing, I was having people put it on their websites. You know, I get 6,000 hits a day on my website, right? Well, I got 145 people to back weird stuff, and that was just enough to make it, just enough to make our goal. This guy had 3,000-something pledged to his deck of cards. So either the public is just more interested in a deck of cards than in crazy conspiracy weird stuff, or he had some other method that we need to learn so that we can utilize it for this network radio stuff, you know, because we're all trying to fundraise to get our networks going and to get everything we want done. And it, I mean, dude, if I had made $150,000, I'd be set. I could make so much stuff. But that's where we're at right now, is in this area of minimum input, maximum output. And, you know, it's going right along with our chaos physics. And I think it's great because, you know, like I say, you know, thousands of people come to the website every day. If these people would realize that $1 or $2 really makes a difference and everybody just kind of tipped at the end of the week or something, you know, here's a dollar, you know, that's $3,000 a week.
Yeah, it seems like common sense. It's like, you know, people, I mean, I'm not a drinker, but, you know, people go out to a bar and buy a $12 drink, you know, and then tip a few dollars. And it's like, hey, we're giving you stuff for free more often than not. Most of the content's free. A dollar or two tip, you know, goes a long way. Add it up.
It really does. And it's one of those things that I've been trying to champion since I started, you know, is just to convince the people. But we're dealing with an interesting crowd because a lot of these people are paranoid in the conspiracy realms, right? And so then they don't want to put their PayPal accounts in there or whatever. And every time I'll say it on the radio, you know, hey, if you guys just tip me at the end of the show, you know, you think it was a great show, send me a couple bucks. I'll literally get that $2, you know, sent to me in the mail. I'll literally get two $1 bills in two separate envelopes, and that's it, you know. So it's a curious thing that we're working with here, and if we're finding a new, you know, we're the pioneers of this. We've altered the world.
Do you think there's also an aspect that people are so used to getting everything for free? Like at this point, like people don't pay for most of the, you know, most media you can find on the internet, even if there is something that's a paid version, they'll, you know, find a torrent or whatever where they can get it for free. And is there a sort of, you know, which of course, like as a person who enjoys these things, it's nice. And then there's the idea of you could end up starving the very thing that you enjoy so much.
Right. Yeah, and people are used to the commercial stream, and so they're used to people getting paid by sponsors. Everybody thinks I'm rich, right? You know, they're like, you're not famous.
You're not rich? But you were rich. I thought that was your thing. You had like a gold bus that like ran on air or something. I completely missed that. I thought you were like a billionaire.
Right? I live like a billionaire. That's the cool part. You know, through synchronicity, through the friendship agenda, I live the life of millionaires without the overhead of having all that stress. You know, I'm more free than a millionaire because I have friends. I can go anywhere in the United States, experience anything I want to do, and it doesn't cost me hardly anything. I have places to go wherever I go. I have the worst time trying to buy my own dinner. So, you know, I live on friendship currency. I don't have money. I haven't bought a pair of shoes in over a year. My clothes are 2 years old. You know, I'd love to have some new clothes. But every dollar I make goes right back into Freeman TV. I mean, everything.
Can I tell you, Freeman, this is probably sounds like a silly thing, but when I met you, that was the first thing I noticed about you. And it, like, I had this smile on my face was I saw that your pants were as old and as ill-fitting as mine. And I was like, all right, this dude's for real.
Yeah, I'm trying to hike them up, you know. Yeah, everything I got's a hand-me-down, and it's where, you know.
Yeah, same here. And I was like, okay, all right. There's no way, like, there's just a sort of genuineness of you could tell. I mean, I don't know. Like, I've seen things like, you know, the different people who, I think it's like Alex Jones and David Icke, which of course are on, you know, larger scales, but they're doing these things where, like, we're not, you know, people think we're so rich off this stuff, but we're not really. Take a look at, you know, I've got this car, and, you know, like David Icke did this video.
I saw that.
Like, this is my car and this is my apartment. And I was thinking, like, okay, that's still kind of nice. Like, not to be like a jerk, just saying, like, I'd be comfortable with that. So, like,
yeah, you're doing okay for doing what you enjoy, for doing just your passion. Like, okay, you know, anybody who's able to do what they act like, what their element is, you know, like in that way, it's like, okay, if you get anything, fucking good for you, dude.
I've learned it has a lot to do with branding. I just sat around and listened to the entire Your Wish Is Your Command by Kevin Trudeau. All 14 discs I listened to, and you could get all of his methods off of 1 hour of my broadcast. I've had three people send me this Kevin Trudeau CD thing that people paid $10,000 to listen to. They were living and presenting this in this extravagant home with kings and billionaires, Skull and Bones members and 33rd degree Freemasons in attendance. I listened to every word Kevin Trudeau said, and it's nothing more than the synchronistic methods that I am describing on my show all the time, you know? It's nothing more. He gave nothing. I give you way more. But he's branded and as this, you know, you can have $1 million type scenario. And so people are paying $10,000 to go listen to this rhetoric. And it's crap as far as I'm concerned compared to what we're doing for free.
Well, maybe that's why we're free. Think about the word branded. He's branded, you know, when you do that to cattle.
Right. You brand a cow.
Yeah. I was blown away by it. I mean, I kept waiting 14 discs later and I kept waiting, you know, where's the point? Here it comes. He's going to say something. No. That's amazing.
I equate you with the Merry Pranksters in my mind. I feel like you're like one of the few people who's like continuing on with that, you know, way of meeting the world. And I appreciate it. So,
hey, we got to freak the norms, man. We got to freak the norms. Get them out of their boxes. Yeah. Can you believe I pushed a school bus for an entire year in a sacred spiral around the United States? I mean, that's physically impossible without being a millionaire, right? I mean, we get 2 miles to the dollar.
Yeah, I mean,
how did
that's,
we do it?
I hear what you're saying, and I think it's more possible than people normally would like to imagine. Like in terms of like when you have something that you're passionate about, like things assist to make it happen. And if you go out there, you know, with a set intention, like. You know, I think things really do work that way, that there is real magic and like, you know, things align sometimes when you're coming from the right place. And so
that's what we were trying to prove. You know, I took something that I considered everybody would think is impossible. I mean, first of all, we couldn't even, you know, I had 75 cents when I bought the damn bus, you know, and we just left, you know, we left. We didn't have enough money to keep going. We closed up our home, put everything in storage, and boom, we were out on the highway. And I mean, the first night out in that big yellow school bus with all of our stuff in it, it just died on the side of the highway. Boom. And we were done. First trip out, first night. And we're like, that's it. We're screwed. You know, what are we going to do now? I don't know how to fix a school bus. Right. You know, first night out. And I called up my friends that we were heading towards, and they actually have an entire fleet of international engines. They run a trucking company for the city, and they're like, just get here and we'll fix it. And so we hobbled that thing. We still, you know, we didn't know what was wrong. It was shutting off going downhill and turning on coming uphill. Does that make any sense, right? We thought there was a golf ball in the gas tank or something. I couldn't figure it out. But we had to shut it off going down, turn it on going up. All through the entire state of Pennsylvania, we used half the gas because we were just coasting half the time. And sure enough, we rolled right in. And the moment we showed up in the school bus was the exact moment that we could have shown up. Even though we were late, it was the exact moment we needed to be there. It was the moment they were done with everything, ready to go. I mean, it was perfect. And sure enough, we just left the school bus with them. They found out what was wrong with it, fixed it, and boom, we were on our way.
Mm-hmm. I think that people have, been like, feel like they've been disillusioned and feel disheartened from a lot of the things that we've actually proven over and over again, you know, just not that long ago, like in the 60s, you know, for real. And people have their set of associations that are kind of like preconditioned to arise when like these things are said. Like people think they know what the 60s were like, even if they weren't there. And I wasn't there, but I can infer enough from what I've heard from people who actually experience certain things that there is like a magic to spontaneity. And when you got your whole being like doing something for the right reasons, things do come together in truly magical ways. And, you know, you're not the first to do what it is that you're doing. I mean, you're the first to, you know, bring some of the particulars of what it is that you're bringing, but there's like an undercurrent of something that's just like inherent in our makeup that like we're truly capable of. And so I think you've tapped into something that a number of people have tapped in before, and that is something that's really important to remember. And yet like people are kind of like programmed not to recognize what's actually possible in that regard, you know?
Yeah, they want to say, you know, oh, you're just a homeless bum, you know? And we're trying to change the lingo and say, no, we're home free. You know, we're free of all that. We have homes all over the United States. We're free. And you know, what was really amazing was that we actually ended up watching the Merry Pranksters film, The Magic Trip, while we were on our trip, and found out that we had done their exact trip in reverse, all the way from New York to La Honda. I mean, right. We went from beginning to end, and we did it backwards.
That's awesome. It's like you continued on with the thing. That's so great.
It blew my mind because we had no idea we were on. You know, we were watching them as they hit each point, and we're like, "Wait, we were there." and even then, we ended up in La Honda, and La Honda, I was given Ken Kesey's jail journals, and sure enough, it says when we got the bus in La Honda. I'm like, no way,
right?
No, But yeah, absolutely. But we're at a point right now where this has never been a time like this before, where we can touch the entire globe through the World Wide Web. Right. And like we were saying, get minimum input and give maximum output. So never before has anyone been able to just travel around and have money deposited into their account. Because like I traveled with the Grateful Dead, I traveled with the Rainbow Family and the Fish Heads and the Cheese Heads and all of the heads. And you always had to go to the show. You always had to go to, you know, get up, get going, let's race. Burr, we got to get there, eat your fast food and get to the show. Set up, you know, okay, sell. And it's a crazy life, you know? I mean, yeah, you'll make $500, maybe $2,500 a day. You can never go back to a wage slave job. But at the same time, you're completely chained inside of this system that you don't, the rest of the world doesn't even know the deadheads exist, and you don't know the rest of the world exists. They've confined you into this microcosm. So for the very first time, we've been able to just be free. We had no set destination, no goals, no nothing. We didn't have to be anywhere. So that's the big difference right now.
Totally. Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah, it's cool to be chatting with you, Freeman, because I think it was one of your shows on it was like Sirius Columbia. It's a good video you did a couple of years ago, and
actually that 7 years ago.
7 years ago, yeah. that video like turned me on to like everything. Really, like I had heard, you know, little bits and pieces of conspiracy and stuff, but. Your method of association, and you know, I remember you mentioned Robert Anton Wilson's Cosmic Trigger in there, and like so that show for me was like the like instigating point that opened up, you know, the next 7 years. So thanks for the good work, because it definitely
thank you
sent me along the way, you know.
I actually considered that my original anti-Illuminati spell, and I guess I could admit that I was actually on mushrooms when I aired that. Not while I filmed it, but when I aired it. It didn't mean to, you know, chocolate fell into my mouth. I didn't mean to have it happen, but I was tripping. And it was midnight on May 1st, which is the Illuminati Day of Creation. You know, it's the May 1st, 1776, when they created the Bavarian Illuminati. On the stroke of midnight on May 1st, I aired my anti-Illuminati spell, which was the Columbia video.
That's awesome.
Now, so I'm curious about something. I mean, this is maybe like a little more specific, but I've been really kind of fixated on this May 1st date lately. Is there's something in like the King Arthur legends. I was reading Mort d'Arthur, and this is this idea that King Arthur at some point has sex with this woman. And he doesn't realize that she conceived a child. And then Merlin comes to him and tells him, "You idiot, you just ruined yourself by having sex with this woman, because this child is going to kill you." You know, it's this sort of like Saturn Zeus thing, you know, it's this idea of like, you know, your one day your child's going to rise up and take your throne. Anyway, he says, the prophecy is that this child's going to be born on May 1st. So what King Arthur does is he commits this genocide, which you don't really hear a lot about in the ideas of this great King Arthur. But he commits this genocide and he kills every child born on May 1st within his kingdom to ensure that the prophecy doesn't happen. But of course, like this one, the one baby that's actually his somehow doesn't get killed, and then the prophecy comes true and all that sort of stuff. But this idea of if Arthur is the sort of genocidal king, and certainly we see like the early Illuminists think this idea of they're the ones who are going to take over the they're going to overthrow the theocracies and monarchs and stuff like that. I think it's interesting that I wonder if they picked that day to align themselves with being the ones to overthrow the king, you know, to overthrow the kings.
Right. Well, May Day's always been quite an experience.
Of course, yeah.
And, yeah, the whole idea of Peter Pan or Robin Hood come from the green man that would lead everybody into the sexual rituals that they would have performed on May Day and, you know, get all the virgins out there in the woods. And I don't know how that would combine with the idea of the genocide, but this has definitely been a powerful day for them throughout the ages for this type of ritual.
Oh, well, no doubt.
They burned the virgin in the man on Beltane, if I'm not mistaken. I'm trying to remember. Right. The Golden Bough is like such a feat to try and like go through and find specific pieces, like if you want something like that, you know. But I think it would be worth it probably to go through and try and find like specific examples where he talks about May 1st in relationship to the king kill. Because, I mean, he goes over the king kill through half the book. You know, I'd be interested in how much of that has to do with May 1st. Also, that's an archetypal story of the king committing the genocide. You have Herod, right? You know, and then you have it from Moses, and then it's repeated in the New Testament with Jesus, obviously. And Jesus disappears to Egypt to escape. But he ends up basically being the king of the Jews, right? And so they put the crown of thorns, which is da'at and totally symbolic. The thorn is the yud on the top of the Zion, which is the crown. So it's a very symbolic thing you're dealing with. That's, I don't think that this actually happened. I mean, it may have, but that's not my feeling.
It's definitely repeating the mythology. It's definitely encoded. Yeah,
it's so classic, like the king committing genocide to find the one child, and then the one child gets away and ends up taking over the kingdom. Like, that's just, you know, but I think it's really interesting, the idea of that in relationship to Beltane and the symbolism of the Maypole in the first place, in terms of you have this double helix being formed, literally. I mean, they wind around the Maypole and wrap this helix around a pole, and then you have the pole, the helix becomes associated with Nahash in Hebrew for serpent, right, which is 358. Which is here you have the Fibonacci sequence being referenced, and they're literally wrapping symbolically the Fibonacci sequence around this pole, which reflects Moses in Numbers 21, where he puts the healing serpent on the pole, and the Israelites come to be healed by the serpent. And I had a friend just telling me that you can basically find, what is it, with the Ark of the Covenant, there's this whole way, I'm not going to give this justice because I just heard this yesterday and I need to research it more. But he was saying that there is actually a reference. You can take all the parts to describing ayahuasca, and that there's basically massive evidence to suggest that in the Old Testament, these people were taking ayahuasca. And here you have ayahuasca is this like serpentine twist, you know, vine, basically. Like it appears like, you know, if you've ever seen serpents have sex, you know, they just twist together in this very like psychedelic way. It looks unreal, you know, but that you have this idea that we're filled with serpents that have taken in toxins, and you introduce the healing serpent and it pulls out the toxins. And in Hebrew, the word for salvation or redemption is the same word for vomit or to purge, you know, and that's probably not a mistake. You know, there's something to that.
Yeah, I think savior and serpent are also, or messiah and serpent have the same gematrial quality too.
Serpent? Oh yeah, Nahash and Messiah. Messiah in Hebrew have, they're both 358.
Right, right.
In gematria, yeah, totally. Which is interesting. I mean, it's just like, and then you have our money, like the symbol of money with the S with the line. I mean, that is the serpent on the pole. Originally, the line was the Tav cross. And so you, and then you see Tav is the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet, which is a half step as a musical note. It's the it's the end of one cycle and the beginning of the next. And so you can see the symbolism of the Messiah in that way. You have the, he's ending a cycle, but the end is also the beginning of the next.
Nice.
So, you know, it's really interesting. And then the cross itself is on the tree, and the tree itself is lightning, and it's also a serpent. So you have the tree of knowledge as to Ot inherent in the tree of life. And basically that the line that runs through it, that is the line of creation, is lightning, and it's a tree. The Fibonacci sequence is the way that a tree branches and the way that lightning branches, but then it's also a snake. And so that's like, that's really fascinating. Like you have this energy that descends, which is our own vitality or kundalini or orgon or whatever you want to call it, you know, and it basically comes into the body, and then it sucks in the toxins into itself. And in most people, it never gets the chance to release. It just fucking festers. And then people act out from their fight or flight mechanism, the pineal gland, which is the reptilian brain, because of that, in all kinds of twisted ways. And so there's, people don't get a heal. And so because there's no, you know, purging, they just go about their lives like thinking that their pineal gland is themselves, and then act from it as if they needed to protect, you know, the thing, because it's a misperception, you know.
And this same symbol is the Freemasonic symbol of the compass square with the G, because that middle pillar up the Kabbalistic tree of life is Gimel or G.
Right.
Camel is its symbol. So that's why you'll see the camel cigarette packs that have the pyramid, Great Pyramid, missing, but the G or the camel standing there in the middle, which is the Hebrew letter G. And so on the Masonic compass square in G, so the compass and square, the, of course, the sexual union of man and woman, and the G being that middle pillar leading straight from Malkuth to Kether.
Isn't it funny that God is often represented as G with a dash and a D? You know, so they don't, they're like, we're not going to write out God. We're just going to write G dash D. And then you have Dalit crosses from, so Dalit crosses from Bina to Chokmah, and then you have the Keter is connected to the Tiferet through the Gimel. So the Gimel and the Dalit actually form a cross within the six-pointed figure that's generated because of Da'at, which is knowledge. And so knowledge itself divides the supernal triad from the seven lower spherot, and in doing so, you have a cross that's formed. So the soul of ignorance itself, or to, you know, ignore our own divinity, is the cross. On that level.
Amazing.
It's funny because the O is omitted, which would be Ayin in the tarot, which would be the devil tarot card. So that, I feel like that's a funny part of the missing divinity narrative, which is, you know, like the way the devil archetype kind of demonizes our animal nature, you know. So I think, yeah, omitting the O or Ayin there is pretty funny.
No, I love that. And then especially because in like the Rider Tarot, he holds up his hand and you can see the symbol for Saturn on his hand. And so you have, he's presenting time. Time is produced from the eternal triad being separated from the seven lower spheres. And in that cross, you have basically the introduction of time. Time doesn't exist before that. In the garden, there is no time. That's pretty far up.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, I want to throw this something in here. While you guys were talking, I thought in the first sync book, page 152, 153, I don't expect anyone to like pull this up right now. I'm just saying, if someone actually wanted to read the whole thing, there, Kyle Hunt's talking about the Bavarian Illuminati founded on May 1st, 1776, May Day. He says, this is the dawning of the May sun. Now, he's saying M-A-Y-S-U-N. But, of course, what I'm throwing out here is it could also be M-A-Y-S-O-N, the sun born on May, born in May. But and he's talking all about the serpent, the money, and all this sort of stuff. It's just kind of funny that I looked to this to see if there was something else here, and there's actually a ton here. But if I can, I want to throw a weird little thing. You guys are talking about, all this sort of, so you have the Tree of Life. We've talked about Skull and Bones, we've talked about all these sort of things. I watched something the other day which blew my fucking mind. It was this Disney movie made, I don't know, probably like 70s. Called The Gnomemobile. Has anyone ever seen this movie?
That is a vague recollection, but yeah, I've seen that. Yeah, when I was a kid, yeah.
I don't even recall.
It is the most bizarre thing. But so I had no idea what I was sitting down to watch. And I'll admit that I was very stoned. So I'm just thinking, like, okay, this is like a little kids movie, something. It just blew my mind on so many levels, because you could literally, what I was able to see is you could come at this movie from any angle and it was all there. There's like this conspiracy angle. There's the Masonic angle. There's this like sexual predator angle. Basically, this grandfather who's like this businessman, he's basically like a Rockefeller. He's like this head of industry and is just shown as this super rich, all-controlling old man. But he loves his little grandchildren. He has this little boy and little girl that he picks up and he drives them in his car. And then they're driving through the redwoods and they pull over into something called like something Grove, right? So, of course, we have Bohemian Grove in the redwoods. And here, as soon as they enter, there's like this owl, this talking owl all over the thing.
Oh, shit.
Right? So it's like, okay, he just took the children alone into the grove with the owl, and I'm like, okay, so you could go the whole pedophile angle. You could say this as all this. And I was like, but while they're there, they end up meeting these gnomes. They meet these, like, mystical beings. Now, you could take this, so it's the little girl sees them first. You could take this as some sort of dissociation if you wanted to go that angle. Or you could just go this whole other angle. There was this weird, like, secret contact with this other realm. Because they're
like
the only
clockwork
ones.
Elves, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now they leave. So they end up doing is they take the gnomes with them into the car and they drive up. And then they have, it's like, well, we can't get to the place we want to go. So we have to pull over at a hotel for tonight. So they pull into a hotel, which was called Something Lodge. So that you went from the Grove to the Lodge.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, right. But so now he's taking the little kids there. But then this whole thing is that everyone thinks they're crazy. And they have this secret that everyone, this whole thing is like people are trying to find out what their secret is and unravel their secret. And they're trying to like hide it. And their whole secret is that they've made contact with this other dimensional beings. The whole, I mean, it's just fascinating on so many levels. I just want to throw out for the, on the conspiracy twist, the pedophile twist, is that the grandfather goes into the hotel and it's just this old man and two small children. And he's got this like suitcase that the gnomes inside. And the gnomes start to like, he's like, hey, let us out of here, something. And the people at the hotel are like, hey, what's in that bag? You know, they start to like ask questions. And he just like gives them money and is like, don't worry about it. I like own this hotel. And they're like, oh, okay, yes, sir, yes, sir. And they let him like, so he's holding a bag of this, like, it sounds like screaming people going, like, let us out of this box. And then, but he's so rich that they don't, no one asks any questions. And it was, like, highly disturbing from that angle.
Yeah.
And like I said, but then there was this whole other, so, like, it just made sense on, like, all these different levels. Because there was also this other, like, a non-negative perspective to look at this movie. It was this really showing this like weird sort of contact. Now, if you want to take that as that these guys are in contact with whether it be machine elves or whatever entities these might be, that's certainly possible. But it was almost like interesting. Again, is that propaganda or whatever it is that they were trying to say, you know, you think we have this big secret, but our big secret is actually that we're trying to help out this interdimensional community. Really bizarre, but it ends with this whole fertility thing, where the whole thing is to try and find the gnome needs a new... he's the last of the male gnomes or something, and he's, like, trying to find a mate. So the whole movie is them trying to get this gnome laid, and then they end up in this place where there's, like, 30 female gnomes, and it's like, actually, we have a ritual here where the women chase you around, and then the one that can hold on to you for like 7 seconds is the one that you marry. And then they do this whole like weird like 10-minute scene of this guy getting chased around by all these women in the middle of this kids movie. It's so bizarre. I mean, Disney's always good for a mind fuck, but
they never cease to fail. Like the princess protection program with Master Mason taking care of all the princesses, and in the gnome mobile you had the two children from Mary Poppins in there, and of course that, you know, bringing me right to the Olympics as I start thinking about it. And then that, when I'm thinking about Mary Poppins at the Olympics and Voldemort slaughtering all the babies in front of everybody in this death ritual, then they also brought in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which was, of course, written by Ian Fleming, who created 007. And, you know, that's all about the evil queen that just wants to capture the children and eat them, I guess. And how much of this programming from that world is going into the children's minds, man. This one you're talking about, the gnome mobile, I'm gonna have to go watch that now for sure.
Oh no.
I can't even begin to tell you how, like, every 3 minutes I was like, no.
So I'd be interested, Freeman, in your feedback on this idea. I'd read something quite a while ago that was really well supported, talking about the idea that the pyramid on the dollar bill is not actually meant to be Egyptian, but Nubian. And they were arguing that the owl in the corner is not actually, in that case, it wouldn't be a Babylonian symbol. If people have this whole deal with that, what's his name? Don't sacrifice your children to Moloch, right? But they were saying that there is actually an owl goddess associated for the Nubians with prosperity, and is like basically a green owl. And so they're arguing that there's, you could take it either way. You could look at it as this kind of like twisted Babylonian thing, and, you know, Egyptian slavery and this and that, and they're all, you know, that, but that the pyramids of the Nubians are actually skinnier, and they're actually, if you look at images, like if you take an image of a Nubian pyramid and then look at the dollar bill and then take a picture of an Egyptian pyramid, it's pretty obvious like what resonates more. So I'd be curious if you've ever heard that or if you have any feedback there, because I thought that was a really interesting idea.
I definitely do have some feedback. One is that you will never, ever, ever find a depiction of Molech as an owl. I challenge you, if you find it, please let me know, because then I'll have to eat my hat.
Oh, awesome.
Alex was wrong, all right? The owl that they are worshiping at Bohemian Grove, as far as I'm concerned, does not represent Molech, because there are no representations of Molech as an owl. He's a bull, you know? He's always been a bull. It's a bull god. But when you start looking to Minerva, Athena, Isis, Lilith, the list goes on and on of the goddesses depicted with an owl. So you will always see Isis with an owl. You'll always see Minerva, Athena, and all of these goddesses depicted with owls. So I've been, you know, my very first blog post is Alex Jones was wrong about Molech. Please change this. And, you know, right. Of course, no one's listening to me. Molech is going to stick until the day it dies. But, you know, I can understand where he came from. They were burning baby effigies to a giant, you know, 40-foot statue, which appears very much like what they would do with Molech, and is what they did with Molech. So I could see where the Molek connection came in, but he didn't study symbolism. He didn't look into these different. So these sacrifices do tend to go to the goddess. And as far as the Nubian section, that's where Queen T comes into the picture. She was the one that brought the Nubian line into the Egyptian pharaonic line, and as far as I've found so far. And this has really been a bafflement because she was brought in at 4 years old. And I don't know why Queen T was suddenly deposited in. And then she gives birth, of course, to Akhenaten, who then turns Egypt on its head with their whole new religion. But now she's Michelle Obama, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, they are identical. I don't know what to say about that other than they're clones. But that's where the whole Nubian line came into this puzzle, and where that. So, yeah, I would say that that could really play into this, because the more and more I dig, the more and more I find these connections to Akhenaten with the Freemasons and with the secret societies. So Akhenaten founded the Rosicrucian Order. Akhenaten is what's worshipped in every Grand Lodge of Freemasonry around the globe. I've been to them all. I've taken pictures. You can see it all. You know, Akhenaten is the religion of the Aten is what I see constantly. So, you know, maybe it all just goes right back to that moment 3,500 years ago when Akhenaten was taking over, and who he was and why that's important is still up in debate.
Minerva was represented with a snake as well, as I recall. There's a snake in the owl, or like her symbols. That's interesting. I don't know. I look at the dollar bill and it feels like it has a pretty much a serpentine feel across its whole thing.
It even looks like snakeskin. Texture. It's a green paper with all that sort of white webbing. Looks almost like snakeskin. Absolutely.
And the eye in the pyramid looks reptilian. You know, not the eye slit itself, but the skin around it looks like scales.
Sure. Yeah, I had this ayahuasca vision of all these snakes that had like descended from the eye above into the pyramid, and were like trying to find their way back to the source, and were basically like being denied. Like it was like a force field was like kept, like they could return, but they couldn't return as they were. Like they had to purge themselves. And
well, how about this? This might blow your mind. It might just be nothing. I'm watching, I check out Disney television often because Disney is the heart of propaganda. Do all your own research. Disney on the front lines. Realize that Disney's the heart of propaganda. That's why they own Star Wars, Marvel, Electronic Arts, pay-per-view television. You know, they are the propaganda arm of the New World Order. So I watch a lot of Walt Disney, and recently they got this TV show called Jesse, and somebody pointed this out to me, and I was totally shocked, and I put the picture up on my Facebook, but I haven't really promoted it yet. But the whole idea, first of all, the show was called Funeral of a Mermaid. And of course, if you know my work, you know, I've been tracking these merfolk and the mermaids and trying to understand the Atlantean connection and all of this. So the title, first of all, grabbed me. But then as I'm watching, the theme of the TV show Jesse on this episode turns out to be, and they stenciled this onto a pillow. It said, with every imaginary death comes a reptilian birth.
Oh God.
And imagine if that were true. Now this guy had it sewn on his pillow and showed it up for the camera to see, the little child. And he's like, with every imaginary death comes a reptilian birth. Now imagine how many imaginary deaths we have watched. If any of this were true,
the TV show.
Yeah. Yeah.
They use the word reptilian.
Dude, with every reptilian death.
There's a reptile is one of the characters on the show, right? I mean, I'm looking at a poster now. What is the deal with this? Do you see that poster that I just put up on there? Did you click on that? It's like all these kids with a fucking reptile in between them, and the reptile's got its hand on one girl's head and the other's shoulder, and it's got like a collar on him like he's a pet.
You're
he's like
so
a
right.
reptile pet. And then if you look at the symbol, like so they have Jesse, and you can see it's obviously buildings. They're like skyscrapers, but then the eye is actually the Empire State Building, which I've gone into like at length. And so Malkuth is translated literally as empire. That is actually one of the most consistent beyond like European occultists who just say kingdom and they kind of beat around the bush. But the empire itself is the Malkuth. And so it's interesting, like when King Kong climbs the Empire State Building, you have your KK1111 climbs this phallic symbol and dies at its tip. You know, it's just like the most symbolic thing. And he like takes the Shekinah with him, you know, in a sense. So you have like the Shekinah is equated with the Malkuth. And so there's, I basically gone into that for at length because I find that the symbolism of King Kong so fucking fascinating. But I like that it's like the eye of Jesse is like the empire state, like that's, and then you have this fucking lizard. I'd be curious to watch this show. I know it might be painful, but it's probably worth it.
Yeah, well, definitely watch the Funeral of a Mermaid. I just dropped the picture into the chat. I think you can see
I see it. Yeah, it is incredible.
Oh wow, that's from the show.
Yeah, I just took a screen cap. I wish I'd caught the little kid's face in it, but it didn't. It was blurry, so I had to go with the one without the head.
What the fuck is that, dude? That's like every time a bell rings, an angel gets its wings, but every time an imaginary... What the fuck?
What is Disney doing, man?
Wow. Weird.
That's crazy, right? Well, so, you know, those same stories came out of Disney as well, what you're talking about with the Empire State Building. If anybody saw Percy Jackson and how they laid out Hollywood as hell and... You know, Rick Royden, who's wrote these books, also wrote The Kane Chronicles, which was all about taking in an Egyptian god form into your soul and letting it take over your soul. Whereas Percy Jackson was more of a bloodline type scenario where you were born of the gods. So, and of course, both of these coming straight through Disney. I mean, The Kane Chronicles with the Red Pyramid, and their first battle was against Apophis. You know, I was actually reading Egyptian Magic by a doctor and reading Rick Royden's Red Pyramid at the same time. And I literally got more out of the magic of the book of Rick Royden than I did out of the doctors. But they were, you know, almost identical. I'll tell you, he was doing his Egyptian magic homework, no doubt about it.
Huh. On the show, the reptile on Jesse is actually named Mr. Kipling, which is most likely a reference to Rudyard Kipling, who was the, you know, Englishman staying in India during the British occupation of India, who was actually one of the few English people revered at the time and beyond by Indian culture, because he was one of the very few who actually made an attempt to understand and study their philosophies. But beyond okay, go ahead.
Well, all of his works are Freemasonic. You know, he's the one who wrote The Man Who Would Be King.
And right. Yeah, which Sean Connery, they made the Sean Connery movie where he's wearing the giant compass and square on his chest. And
then they find this ancient tribe, and the ancient tribe, that's their most secret symbol, and so they worship him as a god. But everything Rudyard Kipling writes is Freemasonic.
Obviously, like the Jungle Book, the man's flower, you know, the red flower, you know, and then his fire and the implications of all
what
of that.
What about the serpent being named Ka, which is the Egyptian concept of like the spirit or soul?
Is that the name of the serpent on Jesse?
The name of the serpent.
In Jungle Book, right, yeah.
Right, and Shere Khan, and every element is very symbolic. And you look at Mowgli's tales, and you can see like you know his level of thinking. But me and Bill's last conversation, we had just brought up Kipling with Apocalypse Now, when Dennis Hopper spouts out the first part of If, where he goes, if you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, yet make allowance for their doubting too. And he's like, he uses that poem to communicate what Kurtz is all about. Like basically Kurtz's whole philosophy of when he talks about the inoculated arms of the children and how they cut off their fucking arms so that they wouldn't get inoculated, you know, like the whole his view on the fucking snail crawling across the edge of a straight razor, like his approach to reality, he represented by Kipling's If, which is really kind of weird. But I like that, you know, obviously, like, it's clever. And then they got the M here of Mr. Kipling on this picture, like, right in line with the Empire State Building again. Just kind of...
So I'm going to be, for anyone who's listening to this app, when I put it online... I'm going to link these images because they're so integral to the conversation. They're really kind of mind-blowing. But on this one where it's the one, David, you put up, where it's the Jesse spelled out with the Empire State Building, and now the reptile has his hand on the girl's head, which is, we could see this as the sort of reptilian brain or her third eye. But look at her hand. So she has her hand, and if you look by her wrist,
that's,
I guess that's...
snake.
Well, it looks like a snake. Yeah, so it's, I guess it's his tail is coming up her wrist, but it looks like a snake. And here we have the idea, you see this very common motif of the serpent wrapped around the woman's arm.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, yeah. No, totally. Yeah, and then you could look at the his tail as like a symbol of like Kundalini or something. Look
absolutely.
At the way that the kid to the left is looking at the tail.
Yeah, he's, yeah, exactly.
He's all like, whoa, what's that about? Wow, that's really weird. I can't even believe it. It's like the whole thing of like, if you put something in plain enough sight, it's like you don't even question it. It's like, of course, there's just this reptile creature like in between these people. That's so weird.
So, but on, I have a personal sync with this stuff. Is that on Halloween, I got invited to go to this. Like Halloween quote unquote party, which is of course like at some bar/club thing. And they have a rooftop bar, but since it's cold outside, they have all these red, thick red robes that you can wear so that, cause it's cold outside. So everyone's standing there in their red robes. It's like some scene at Eyes Wide Shut, right?
Uh-huh.
And you're, it's like a few blocks away from the Empire State Building. So I'm standing on this rooftop bar looking up at the Empire State Building. And we went there with a bunch of my wife's Japanese friends. And so this other friend says something like some joking thing about the not like a racist thing, but like a joking thing about the Asians there. And I'm like, this is while I'm standing there looking at the Empire State Building right after you and I had a conversation about the Empire State Building as Malkuth. Now, you know, there's the other name for Malkuth is being Asia. This is what Jason Brera is always pointing out, is that when there's an Asian reference, he believes it to be a reference to Malkuth. Mm-hmm. They call it Assiah, I believe. So you have Malkuth as Asia.
Oh, you're saying Asia because of the world. It's the world that Malkuth belongs to, yeah.
Yeah, so... I'm looking at the Empire State Building, and she goes something about Asians or something. I'm like, oh, crap. So it's like this like personal, you know, there's this thing where the stuff seeps in. You know, no one planned that. That was a personal thing. So I'm not claiming that's what it is for Disney. I'm just saying, like,
right.
On a personal level, it's like you see how this stuff, this is where I get kind of, from a personal level, I feel like having looked at all this stuff, there's many instances where people put these things in intentionally. Without a doubt, this is very, very intentional, and it raises all sorts of really interesting questions. But then there's the other fact that does seem to happen naturally. There is this stuff where, if you're paying attention, these archetypes emerge completely organically through synchronicity. So my question I want to sort of throw out, and you guys can, you know, hash this out, is it that, you know, does this go to some sort of, like, Gnostic matrix concept that if we're experiencing these archetypes, and these are the archetypes that these guys revere and intentionally insert, is this proof that they are creating this matrix, or is it proof that instead that perhaps these old schools were actually correct, that they figured out sort of how archetypes emerge and then decided to kind of play with them, revere them, and integrate them into their artwork? I feel like those are sort of the two more obvious ways you can go with that. Any thoughts?
Yeah, you could argue that if something is set up kind of like foundationally, like if you lay down the sun square, so to speak, if you're building on something, on if you set up parameters energetically, that things tend to align in more direct ways, possibly. I don't know. I had considered the idea that there's certain parameters that are set up and then things... and so, I mean, my personal feeling is that it's obviously both. I feel like there's intentional playing with the archetypes, and then there's where they merge on their own just because of the nature of the setup.
I feel like it's kind of like the way I look at it is that, like, you know, nature, we're all nature, you know, so like nature is doing its thing in our actions as much as it does, you know, out in the plants and fields and atmospheres. So like when I look at all that's going on, I think what the mystical traditions have grabbed a hold of is the power of mimicry, which is like, you know, looking at nature in a kind of scientific way and reflecting upon its purposes, and then finding ways to align oneself and one's activities with those processes to like blossom in a way that's conducive to the universe. So I feel like culture has always been a reflection process of like reflecting nature, understanding it down, expressing it. And I think what we're seeing a lot nowadays, where, you know, wisdom is being misused, obviously, like we're seeing in like a lot of, you know, stuff, we can see really easily how, you know, mystical and occult mythologies and patterns are kind of used in a mysterious way. And I think
hey, Kev, I'm going to, you're cutting out on the
arts and stuff too, is to constantly listen.
Kev, I'm just going to hang up on you and bring you right back because you're cutting out, okay?
Okay.
Yeah, that's a tough question. And one that I tend to go to is, you know, what came first, the title or the corporate logo?